It's incredible with the amount of advocacy that can go on the internet. Young people especially can look to see that, you know, adults in their own community and in the United States, in their country, are fighting for them in ways that they would never would have known about before.
Welcome to Think About Policy, a podcast series brought to you by the Global Alliance for Behavioral Health and Social Justice. I'm your host, Geeta Jaffe, Senior Policy and Global Affairs Advisor for the Global Alliance. We are an interdisciplinary organization dedicated to informing policy, practice, and research since 1923. Today, we are releasing part two of our three-part series on youth mental health, the role of advocacy, social media, and communication. Before we get started, we have a content warning for this series, which includes discussion about depression, suicide, and suicidal ideation. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce my co-host for this series of episodes, Dr. Amelia Burke Garcia, a seasoned health communications professional with nearly 20 years of experience in program planning, implementation, and evaluation. Amelia, welcome back, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Geeta. It's great to be back with you. Wow, what an incredible story Diana shared with us in that last episode. I really hope people listening to this episode have heard or take a moment to go back and listen to her story.
Yeah, in our first episode of the series, we heard from Diana Chow about her personal mental health journey and learned of the important work she is leading with regard to supporting the well-being of youth in the settings they are in. In today's episode, we will discuss opportunities and threats of social media toward youth mental health. We know that the COVID-19 pandemic has interrupted routines, increased isolation, and use of technology while fracturing social connection, all of which could impact youth mental health and well-being for many years to come. So what can be done to promote well-being? What is the role of advocacy in achieving this? And how should we be thinking about social media? Amelia, let's get started with episode two.
Joining us now is Adrian Smith. Adrian is an 18-year-old activist who made history at his Catholic high school as the first transgender man to ever openly transition. Adrian's numerous obstacles and mental health struggles have inspired him to fight boldly for equality in LGBTQ+ healthcare, and he aspires to become an openly transgender medical professional. Adrian, thanks so much for joining us today. We're so thrilled to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk about, you know, mental health and everything with the media. And I think it's really important, especially for LGBT, you know, individuals to have these conversations and to know that, you know, the media is going to have, you know, oppressive nature just like everything else, and you know how to navigate that for sure.
So Adrian, I want to start this conversation out and just to learn a little bit more about you. So can you tell me and our listeners a little bit about your story?
Oh, totally. Yeah. So I grew up in the Catholic school system, and, you know, I had always been in the Catholic school system. So, you know, it was expected that I went to a Catholic high school, and in the process of being in that Catholic high school is when I really realized that I was transgender. And that experience was like, it was really shocking to me, but also really eye-opening. And I tried as much as I could to find resources that could help me. But due to, you know, multiple instances of our school's administration, you know, not being in staff as well, not being up to date with, you know, everything that we needed as LGBTQ+ students, it was really hard to navigate that. And that is why I really started my advocacy. And I started working in like our school's LGBT club, which wasn't really a big deal back then because nobody was really a part of it. But I really wanted to grow that club. And that's what I ended up striving to do throughout my 4 years of high school, is to grow this club and to make people realize that they're not alone. And throughout that experience, I also became involved with, you know, a youth-led publication in Cincinnati. And I became involved with the Human Rights Campaign because, you know, it's something that I felt was not only important for my school, but, you know, for the country and for everyone that was in my community.
That's wonderful. So I'm curious your thoughts on how youth are doing today. You know, there have been lots of different types of reports in terms of youth and their mental health, the impact of the pandemic, other issues they're facing. How do you think they're doing?
Yeah, so I think the pandemic was really hard for youth in a number of ways, especially with the close proximity with their families. You know, a lot of people aren't out to their families. A lot of people are only out, in terms of my own experience with people I know at school, to their own classmates or to people that are their friends at school. So I think the pandemic was especially challenging for LGBTQ plus individuals, because really they're stuck either by themselves or with their family that may or may not be supporting, or they may or may not have come out to. And I think in terms of today, we are at a very unfortunate state in this country. I think that we've kind of reached a trend in terms of legislation with cities, with states, you know, even with the Senate, you know, coming up with legislation and bills and, you know, all of these, just legislation in general that is very oppressive, and other states, other parts of the United States just kind of piggyback onto that. And unfortunately, it creates this trend where you just have oppression, you know, going throughout the country. And it's really hard to stop because of how rapidly it's spread and how rapidly it's copied. And if one thing is passed, then it's very likely that in another part of the United States, something very similar can be passed. And part of what I work with the Human Rights Campaign is really, you know, addressing the root of that situation, saying, how can we stop this from spreading? How can we stop this from happening in the first place? How can we take a stand? It is really hard to change the mind or alter what would be called, you know, the elites of this country, who generally are not diverse and generally are not LGBTQ plus. So that has all been very hard. And I think that has a big toll on the mental health of LGBTQ plus individuals right now. But I think that in a similar vein, all of these things that are going on really does inspire growth and really does inspire people to really, you know, be thinking, what can I do to, you know, challenge this legislation? What can I post about that's, you know, making everyone aware of what's going on? And I've seen that a lot too. So I almost feel like it does bring to light, similarly to the BLM movement, all of the terrible things that are happening in a way that we can hopefully change for the better.
Yeah, so that you've made a lot of really important points in that response. And so I want to break that down a little bit. So in terms of the things that are negatively affecting youth and their mental health, what role do you think social media plays in that?
I think, and what I've seen a lot in the LGBTQ plus community, is there's not only, you know, oppression online, and you have like these, you know, dueling sides where everything on the internet is very polarized, and you don't know, you know, all you ever see is things that are very for what you believe in or very against what you believe in. There's that issue, of course. But additionally, what I see is there's a lot of underlying struggles with, you know, what constitutes a particular identity. I mean, when people are growing into their identity and thinking about, you know, what they might identify as, paradoxically, there's a lot of rules that people with that own within that own community impose on these labels. You'll see, you know, posts of people saying, I've seen this, you know, these are things that bisexual people do, or these are things that lesbians do. And it almost creates this illusion that if you don't do one of these things, or if you don't, or if you're not encompassing this list, then you are not that identity. And it almost creates this contradictory sort of, you know, acceptance where people, you know, want to fit into something that is very accepting, very open, but that own community is kind of turning against them and labeling them again in a way that they don't like. So I really think that's a big important role too. Despite all of the polarizing language and even political statements.
Those are really important factors, I think, in sort of what youth, in particular LGBTQ plus individuals, are experiencing today. How do you think, you mentioned some of the positive things though, so how do you think the social media can actually be supportive?
I think that social media can be very supportive within communities such as the one I'm a part of, right? So I'm part of a community that's very Catholic, very, very one way. I mean, my school doesn't even have, you know, very much racial diversity or religious diversity. It is very much cisgender, heterosexual, white women that attend my school. And once you're a part of that community, and all these people that are part of communities similar, once you're a part of a community that is so uniform for so long, and you don't really have a way to escape, you know, you're too young, you haven't gone off to college yet, it can feel like the entire world is that same uniform type of person. And one hugely positive thing about social media and the internet is that you are exposed to everybody. There is not, you know, a particular demographic that is always shown. You know, you, even if there is one that's predominant, you have representation across the board. And, you know, while that can be negative in a sense that you may be exposed to people that are against you in ways you've never even thought of, it also opens the door to have conversations with people that you can finally say are like you, right? You can finally see somebody online that might be the same identity as you, an identity that you've never, you know, met somebody with before. You might, you know, have good conversations with people online about your own personal lives, such as, you know, you both can't come out to your parents yet. And, you know, all of that can be very, very helpful in a way that's also anonymous and protecting and can't be spread to your own community to harm you. And obviously, as I said before, additionally to that, it's incredible with the amount of advocacy that can go on the internet as well. I mean, and it's the fastest way to spread information. So just as much as there's negative information spread, there are huge, huge advocates that are fighting and that young people especially can look to see that, you know, adults in their own community and in the United States, in their country, are fighting for them in ways that they would never would have known about before.
Yeah, those are really, really important points, I think. So when you think about some of the struggles that youth, and in particular LGBTQ plus youth, are experiencing now, but also some of the opportunities that social media afford this community, what would you like to see in terms of promoting well-being? What would you like to see happen? And how can social media support that?
I definitely think a lot of advocacy that goes on social media is very passive. And while that, you know, while having that representation and posting about it is wonderful in the first place, I think that a lot of the times people kind of, you know, they'll see a post, you know, promoting LGBTQ plus well-being, they'll repost it. But just spreading that knowledge does not get us to where we ideally would be, right? Where people are actually taking that information and using it to make a difference. I mean, spreading awareness is, you know, the first step. But I really think that using social media platforms to give more options of things that people can actively be doing right now would really, really help the state of where we are at. In terms of LGBTQ plus well-being and communicating what we need to political officials, to you know, youth well-being coordinators, to teachers, it would be very helpful, you know, to have that kind of opportunity to really become involved. And even advertisements are great. You know, people can, you know, advertise more about a certain organization, or we're meeting here at this time, or you can feel free to email us if you want to have the conversations about this, or we're having an event. All of those things are very open doors for people to, you know, experience advocacy actively, right? So it's, that is what I love to see so much more happen, and what I think would really make more of an impact in our country in general, rather than just passively, you know, passing along information in a way that, you know, might fly over people's heads because there's so much information being like put right at them in a day, you know?
Yeah. And you mentioned a lot of different types of players or actors who can get involved. So I've heard advocates. I've heard organizations. I'm curious who you think needs to be at the table to make that difference so that it gets beyond just the information sharing and becomes more of a deeper discussion around rights and support for communities' needs.
I think really that what I see a lot of the time is there's, you know, really, really big companies such as the Human Rights Campaign, the Trevor Project, you know, that really, really try their best and, you know, promote all sorts of awareness, all sorts of ways that you can, you know, get into contact with changing things and, you know, with government officials, et cetera. But what I think could be, you know, a really big piece of this puzzle is kind of getting organizations that are a little bit smaller or more in between, you know, to really make more of a reach out. Because obviously, if you have the Human Rights Campaign advocating for a cause, giving resources, the average person can only do so much. Because the organization is national, you might be able to make some phone calls, you might be able to potentially volunteer at a local chapter of that organization, but it's really hard to access that information because it's so large. So really, I think some of the biggest people that should be at play here is the people that are, you know, working for, let's say, a local LGBTQ plus support organization in Cincinnati. You know, there's organizations in Cincinnati, but I don't know a whole lot about them because they post about what they do and, you know, maybe the donations that they have and when to donate, but they should, I believe, post more about, you know, how you can get involved, because it's so much easier and more connecting with people to, you know, think, I can be involved in my city, or I can be involved in, you know, my, you know, small community, versus the overwhelming nature of, you know, having to contact a national organization or contact, you know, the House of Representatives, or that can just be very overwhelming. So I almost think, paradoxically, taking those smaller steps and, you know, getting in touch with smaller communities and those smaller communities getting in touch with the common population would be of the biggest help right now.
That's great. And so what I'd love to do is, you know, we've talked a little bit about your perspectives on these issues more broadly, and I'd love to sort of circle back to some of your own experiences and in particular, kind of the work you do advocating for LGBTQ plus rights in your high school, in your community. And in particular, you know, as it relates to youth and mental health and social media, schools, you know, should be safe spaces for kids. And so I'm wondering what your thoughts are in terms of how, what you've gone through in your school, how the policies and practices that you've experienced, and in some cases, you know, have been able to change. What is the impact on your mental health and your well-being been?
I think that just being a part of a community that is, you know, completely, almost completely, you know, female identifying, like identifying as women, has been very, very hard on its own. Not even taking into consideration the school and, you know, the teachers and youth serving professionals' perspectives. I think that it's been really hard on top of everything that is already different about me. Due to freshman year, we had, you know, a bunch of scandals with how much representation of LGBTQ plus topics can we have. And we've had problems with the board, and it's very damaging to one's mental health. It really makes you want to kind of like take yourself out of the light, you know, not participate in many things anymore. And I started to experience that really. And I realized after a period of time that, you know, if I were to do that, it would only be, you know, what, you know, the parents and what the school and what the Catholic Church would want, and wouldn't be, you know, for the good of the community as a whole. And I think that really getting past that and deciding to make that jump to really start working for the opposite direction and really start working for change rather than stagnancy was really important for me, pushed me out of my comfort zone, but in the best way possible. And I would recommend that to anyone that that's a possibility for, to really take that step to, you know, try to go out of your comfort zone and, you know, how much of a difference you'll make and how many people you'll meet that were scared to come forward at first, but now have the ability to talk to you about it.
So Adrian, sort of following on kind of what you've learned through your experience, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on what some key components are for schools that every school should consider putting in place or having in place in order to create safe and supportive environments for their entire student bodies.
Right. So I think first and foremost, it is almost paramount that every school has some sort of gay straight alliance in the building. I know that most schools have this opportunity, but sometimes it's not very well moderated, and sometimes it's made unsafe for students because of who's running it, the reputation it has, what is publicized about it, and then people don't want to go, which was the case at my school for a number of years until I, you know, I really wanted to take the time to, you know, communicate to people that, you know, this really is a safe space. And, you know, I started bringing food in and I started, you know, having fun games, you know, and even small gestures like that that make something feel more like home can really be helpful for organizations where it is very hard to maybe even show up. So that, I think that is paramount. And I think that good publicity and equal publicity of these alliances is very important, so that these students do not feel like the school secretly doesn't want it to be in the running and secretly is, you know, trying to hide it, because that happens very frequently as well. I think secondly, it is paramount in terms of addressing student bodies in terms of gender identity, that is taken into deep consideration. So obviously at my school, it is a traditionally all girls Catholic high school. But there is probably, you know, about 5% of our student body that identifies as a non-woman, identifies as either non-binary, agender, or transmasculine. I'm the only person that is actively on hormones as a trans man. But I think that, you know, just the small efforts that you make in class, you know, not saying, oh, ladies, you know, get this out. You know, it's very easy not to say words like that. It really is easy. And additionally, in terms of that, when you're in a classroom space, it's so helpful for teachers to just send out, you know, a Microsoft form or make a survey in the beginning of the year where students can share their name. Because, I mean, everyone has at schools, the teacher is going to ask, if you go by something else, tell me. That's normal for cisgender people, and it should be normal for transgender people to be able to say, this is the name that is going to be on the roster, but this is the name that I go by and that I'm comfortable with, and that should be respected equally. And in addition to that, you know, obviously pronouns, if cisgender people's pronouns are respected, transgender students' pronouns should be respected as well. And I think that having a few teachers in my time at my school that have, you know, allowed us to say what our pronouns are and when we would like those pronouns and name to be used is just so helpful. It is the basic respect that should be granted to all students and that proves that all students are equal. And also I would advocate, especially for LGBTQ plus students, and if there's a gay straight alliance, for that to be taken into equal diversity consideration as if there were, you know, like racial, you know, like student union, like Black student union. I know at my school, we have Asian American Pacific Islander student union, and those are wonderful. And I have been able this year, due to my school making more intersectional events, to engage with all of those other clubs. And it's just fantastic to have that kind of intersectionality, because there's so many people that have, you know, a number of minority identities that they always feel are isolated from one another and that they're not able to celebrate at the same time. And, you know, having collaboration events with all of these different diversity clubs and treating them all equally is just spectacular in terms of, you know, making sure everybody feels that their identity is represented at school.
That's great. And I'm curious, it's sort of a final point. What, if any, role social media may have in providing some of those supports or other protective factors?
I think that it's very, very helpful in terms of social media when there's all these different social media accounts affiliated with different schools. I mean, this could be colleges, this could be high schools, this could be grade schools, and usually it's in high schools. But many, many high schools have, you know, multiple accounts for that high school pertaining to diversity clubs, pertaining to sports, maybe art, photography, et cetera. And that option on social media allows it for, you know, basically the first time ever for these schools to actually communicate and collaborate. So, I mean, it at least in my school, I mean, we've had several events that are diversity related that we've actually collaborated with a whole nother school on. So when you have, you know, you have your own school and you have your own school's clubs, your own school's events, but really, to broaden that perspective to the maximum degree, social media is amazing for getting those kinds of connections at other places and really bringing that community together. Because if one school system is flawed, they may not realize it, and the students may not realize it because they're so isolated in that one community. And you almost need like other schools to have events with you and for everyone to really understand each other and potentially check each other if something is not right or something is unjust. That's a policy at that school or the behavior that's going on. And just having that sort of connection that can just go over an entire state or multiple states is amazing. I mean, I know with my school, we have chapters of our school or building, you know, our schools in, you know, multiple states. They're all across the United States. All of those schools, even though they're the same school, they're going to have different events and representation and situations going on, and we can all help each other. It's exactly the same. And I think social media is great with that. And the heightened use of collaboration through social media in schools would be amazingly helpful. And with corporations as well, communities that are working towards a common cause, just having that communication is just so easy and can be used for the good.
That's great. Well, thanks so much, Adrian. This has been a wonderful conversation. We're so pleased to have your perspective as part of this conversation today.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I love providing any kind of insight that I can. I've experienced so much, but I'm excited to experience more. And I'm excited to, you know, experience so much of a broader student body in college, because I'm moving from Cincinnati to California to study at Stanford University. And it's just going to broaden my perspective even more. And I'm so excited to, you know, get just so much more representation and just learn so much from other people. Learning from other people is my favorite part of life, really.
Adrian's experience and advocacy work are great examples of actionable steps that individuals and communities can take to support youth well-being, and we wish him the best at Stanford next year. Our next guest will be discussing practical action-oriented steps that can be taken by youth, their parents, and supporting policies to promote youth mental health.
Joining us now is Sherry Gordon. Sherry is a bullying prevention advocate and the author of nearly 20 books for teens and tweens. She's the former editor of Columbus Parent Magazine and holds a BA in Public Relations and Speech Communications. Welcome, Sherry. We're so honored to have you join us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Sherry, I just want to start out hearing a little bit more about yourself and your work. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into this work and what you do?
Sure. Well, I've always kind of had a passion for the underdog and those that aren't really being treated well, and I've always wanted to do something to help. So initially in my career, I started out in marketing and public relations, and I did a lot of volunteer work. And through that, I found that the best way to help people was through educational type writing. And so I kind of transitioned from there into writing books for tweens and teens. And I largely focus on bullying prevention and safety online, cyberbullying, social media, that sort of thing. And I also am a journalist for several online publications, one of which where I'm a bullying prevention advocate.
In your work as a bullying advocate and in terms of your work as a journalist, I'm sure you've encountered, the issue of social media and youth mental health and how those things are connected. And I'm wondering what you've learned through this process in terms of the impacts, whether positive or negative.
Well, from the research studies that I've read, I've found that social media can have both a negative impact on mental health as well as a positive impact. It really just comes down to how kids are using social media and how they're interacting with the platform. For example, if kids are just scrolling through social media and without a real purpose, they might start to develop what's called FOMO, or fear of missing out. And social media can also impact their self-esteem. It can lead to loneliness, depression, anxiety. And even if they are experiencing like online shaming or cyberbullying or catfishing or something along that line, the consequences to their mental health can be even more significant. That said, there are some studies that have found that social media can be good for mental health when it's used properly. So kids that are able to connect with others that share the same passions they do might feel encouraged or empowered, or kids that perhaps have a serious medical condition or a life-threatening illness might find support online and feel less alone. Even for kids that live in like rural communities or have limited options for interacting with other people, social media can fill that gap for them. So there are both good and I wouldn't say bad, but negative consequences of social media. And I think it really just comes down to how they're using it.
In terms of the negative aspects, right? So the risks that come with social media use in terms of youth and their mental health, what do you think is needed to address the issues?
I think when it comes to social media, it's first important for people to recognize that we live in a digital world now, so social media isn't going away. And so I think from the very beginning, it's really important to teach young people how to use social media responsibly and with intent. And in other words, I know there's a lot of talk about limiting time on social media, which is definitely a good thing. But I think that education really is at the root of kind of combating those negative consequences. In other words, teaching teens to think about social media differently and to use it differently, I think could really offset some of the negative mental health concerns that we have.
So in terms of maybe what youth should be more aware of, you talked a little bit just now about education, but what do you think youth should sort of be on the lookout for or be thinking about as they use social media?
Well, I kind of have about five things that I really think that teens need to know about social media. And the first is that they should use it with purpose. Instead of like mindlessly like scrolling through their feed, they need to log on with a purpose, even if that purpose is just to connect with family and friends that they haven't seen in a while. They should get on social media with a goal in mind. And I also think that they need to learn how to curate their content that they put online, leverage the power of social media to their advantage. So in other words, if they're passionate about a topic, they could be posting about it and connecting with others who share the same passion. And then also, of course, you know, they need to hone their media literacy skills. And what I mean by that is recognize credible sources of information and use their analytical skills to determine what they believe about a topic rather than just taking in what they see on social media. They kind of look at it critically and really think about it. And then obviously, probably most importantly, is that they know how to stay safe online and what to do if they're ever bullied or shamed or cyber-stalked or something like that.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about parents. So we talked a little bit about what youth should be on the lookout for and what they can do if they experience some of these negative things in social media. What should parents be kind of thinking about or aware of or looking for with regards to their kids and social media use and mental health?
Well, I think the obvious place to start is to be mindful of how much time their teens are spending online, what types of things they're posting, and how they appear to be doing overall. Those are just like the basics. And I always advise parents to follow their kids online so that they can interact with them online, but just so that they have a gauge of what they're doing. I also, though, think that it's even more important that they have ongoing conversations with their kids about social media. In other words, if they see something, if the parent sees something online, they can open a dialogue with their child and get a sense for what their kids are thinking about what they witnessed. And sometimes those conversations, I think, provide so much more insight than just trying to observe their child or restrict their social media use in some way. I really think it's important for parents to realize that we live in a digital world and social media is here to stay. And it's better to try to teach our kids how to use social media responsibly than it is to set a bunch of rules or restrictions on them. Although, I mean, I do think having guidelines is important, but I think it's even more important to educate a young person on how to use social media in the right way and in a way that won't harm them mentally.
That's great. So I'm curious your thoughts, you know, in terms of policy and policy change and where that all fits in terms of the issues we've been talking about today. Do you have thoughts on policies that are needed or should be considered, or how much policy change is needed in terms of being able to address some of these issues?
For me personally, I think the key lies more in education. And I've always envisioned a class at the middle school or high school level that teaches everything from how to use privacy settings on social media to how to use it responsibly. I mean, the class could even be expanded to have kids do some research on the impacts of social media and mental health and how to use social media as a tool for college acceptance or resume building, stuff like that. But I do know some states have mandates with classes like this, but I really feel like it's something that should come more at the national level so that it's more consistent. And, you know, as I said before, social media is here to stay, and our kids are born into this digital world, and we have a responsibility to educate them on how to use these tools effectively and without harm. And I think it's just as important as teaching them how to drive, really.
Yeah, that's such a good point, right? It's sort of a fundamental life thing for kids to learn. It's a really important point. Okay, so just a final question, Sherry. You know, we've talked a little bit about what youth should be aware of, what parents should be on the lookout for, and the role of policy. And so now I just would really welcome your thoughts on where the technology companies fit into all of this. What roles do they play?
Well, I think when developers created social media platforms, they likely didn't envision how it might be used inappropriately or how it could harm people if they are shamed or trolled or cyberbullied online. I also imagine they didn't realize how it could impact a person's mental health either. But now that social media has been around a while and we have some studies showing what could happen, I believe that social media platforms have a responsibility to make their sites safer and to take a more proactive role when it comes to making sure when a person's using it that their mental health is not negatively impacted or that their person is not bullied or cyber bullied or shamed or something like that. And here are some examples of what I think social media platforms could do to kind of address those issues. And they don't need to be legislated. They're just something that they could proactively do on their own. And the first of which is they could develop a system where they alert people that, hey, did you know you've been online now for an hour? And some people will use those alerts to limit their time use and others will ignore them. But I think it's an important point to offer something like that. I also think they could use the platform to do PSAs about protecting your mental health. During COVID, we saw where social media platforms regularly provided updates, or they might have had PSAs about vaccines or numbers of cases and so on. And I think that they could do the same thing when it comes to mental health and just kind of mimic what they did with COVID in promoting taking care of yourself mentally. And then I also believe that they could better handle the abuse that takes place on social media platforms. So in other words, it's gotten better over the years, but it still could use some improvement of when you're cyberbullied or someone shames you or someone cyberstalks you, making that reporting process a little bit easier and less cumbersome for people and taking action right away, I think would really go a long way in protecting a person's mental health, because cyberbullying really can have significant consequences for someone. And I just feel that social media platforms have an obligation to make sure that their sites are safe for everyone to use.
Well, thanks so much, Sherry. I think those are really good points to end this conversation on. This has been so enjoyable and I've learned a lot from talking to you. So just thank you for being here today and for sharing your knowledge with us and for all of our listeners.
Thank you so much for having me. This is something that I really enjoy talking about and I really appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Thinking About Policy. As we heard more about youth mental health, the importance of advocacy efforts, the impact of policy on well-being, and practical recommendations for promoting youth mental health, particularly in relation to virtual environments. We really appreciated our conversation today with Adrian Smith, Sherry Gordon, and Amelia Burke-Garcia. Please join us next time for the final episode of the series on youth mental health and the roles of social media and communication, which is focused on youth mental health and communication tools and pathways. As always, you can find the Global Alliance on the web at bhjustice.org, on social media at All for BH Justice, and in Baltimore in October when we are hashtag Together for Action 2022. Please join us in thinking about policy.